How about I give you the last four lines?
Please. I think that we need that.
Before the cutoff.
Okay.
And his bowels unplugged, and his nostrils ripped, and his bottom burnt off, and his penis, and that's where it's cut. That's where it cuts off.
So turn to King Arthur, who says, on second thought, you can do it.
On second thought, it is a silly place.
Let us not go to Camelot. Mm-hmm. It is a silly place.
Which, here's the thing, Monty Python does that all the time. Mm-hmm. They approach something serious, they jump all over it, you're hearing theoretical views about something, they're talking math, they're all very educated men who can talk that business, but they're like, I mean, opposite to this line, they're like, on second thought, let's not go to Plato. Let's go to the silly place.
Yeah.
Like, it's their antithesis line. They're like, yeah, we could get serious about this, but life doesn't need to be that serious.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that. I'm sorry, not to wax too poetic on let us not go to Camelot, to the silly place.
It's okay.
They're all about the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. It's just they got to say the opposite of the opposite of that now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all I had to say.
So I believe it's at this point that they get their quest to look for the Holy Grail from God.
Yes. There's a wonderful animation by
Terry Gilliam.
Terry Gilliam, you prince among men. Like, his animations are phenomenal. Mm. I mean, like, if you like this series, then you have to like Terry Gilliam's stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know many people who dismiss it. I mean, artistically, it's just fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Arthur does the voice, the actor that does, which one of him is of the Pythons? He's the one that passed away. I just don't remember his name.
His name, of course, Jonathan, is Graham Chapman.
Yeah. Yeah. God rest his soul.
But yeah. He not only is Arthur, he does the voice of God, which is something that happens. It's not a rare occurrence.
It's interesting because I think, this is also not a religious podcast, mm-hmm. but Jonathan pointed out earlier, and I'm going to give you credit, dear, but it's a frequent trope to have God speaking to the main protagonist with their own voice.
Right. It's almost like they're talking to themselves.
I mean, if God's going to talk to you, he's going to talk to you in a voice that convinces you. And what convinces you most of everything?
Right. Your own voice.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. And Prince of Egypt was the one that I called out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I never watched Prince of Egypt, but I'm pretty sure it was amazing.
Val Kilmer, mm-hmm. As God talks to Val Kilmer as Moses.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And then we get like a 30-second opening title scene that says Monty Python, or it says, I believe it's just the quest for the Holy Grail. I don't think that it says Monty Python.
Yeah, I definitely call it the intro, which is funny because this is probably part 2 or 5 of this podcast.
We're about like a third of the way through the movie, maybe a quarter of the way through the movie, and we now just get our title.
I noticed that a lot of the peasants in this film are always like stacking mud or like fiddling around with like hay and stuff. Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what the stage direction was, but I find it very fascinating that it must have been something like, look busy with mud.
Yeah.
Look busy with hay. Look busy with like chickens running around you and people are like squishing stuff around.
Hit a cat against a wall.
Oh my gosh. That was back in the dead the bring out your dead scene.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, Lids, that's my brother's least favorite character.
It's not the only time that they're abusive towards cats.
Some cat gets stepped on at some point, right? Yeah.
They throw a cat in the next scene when they're throwing a bunch of different animals. Anyways.
Okay, so now they've gotten their commission from God. We've had a title sequence. And now they approach the French castle, you might mm-hmm. call it.
Yeah, with insults that work even to this day.
Oh, John Cleese, throw your insults at me through the voice of mm-hmm. Lydia Malcolm.
I said, taunt you a second time.
Okay, so John Cleese, who we all know I have a crush on, right? He's at a parapet. He's
yeah.
on the top of a castle looking between two little things. And he's like, he keeps his hands over the edge with these, like, he's got these gauntlets on, right?
Yeah.
And he's got them propped over the edge and he just kind of sits there like a Muppet. And every time he like says something, he like flips his hands and like he flips his other hands and then he like flips both his hands. And then like he'll say an insult and then he'll like bap his own head and then he'll be like, John Cleese can give like scouring insults and then do something physically hilarious in like this quick succession that you should be like, oh, this is ridiculous. I dismiss it immediately. But you're like, no, I'm going to be saying everything he said. I fart in your general direction. I'm going to say this stuff with no shame.
Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries.
That's my favorite insult. And I know it's the one that's over the top, but I can explain it. The mother, you're a hamster part talks about the promiscuity of your mother, a fast breeding rodent, right? So your mom gets around and she has a lot of kids.
Yeah.
Right? Your father smells of elderberries is calling your dad a drunk because they would make liquor out of elderberries. So he's like, your mom's a whore and your dad's a drunk. And I'm like, when I got that explained to me, I was like, John Cleese.
Yeah, that's not nearly as smart as mine, which was just, you know, constantly calling the English knigget.
which once we looked it up is pretty cool because it's like the phonic, like say it how you spell it.
Yeah.
Of knights.
Yeah.
Knigget. Which I thought was at first was a racial slur. So God bless Googling it because I was like, oh, just knights, but knigget. All right.
But
I'm like, I can use it now.
Yeah. And Arthur and his band don't really like back down to the point where the French get them to run away by throwing animals at them like cows and chickens.
There was an actual incident where this happened, by the way. There was a battle in France where the outside army was starving out the people inside the castle, and they were like, we're gonna starve you to death, ha ha. And so they were like, quick, get everything you can eat and throw it over the wall. And they threw like freshly baked bread and animals over the wall, and they were like, you guys, we got food for days. And they were like, and so they left, and they were like, good, because we were about to starve to death. We threw everything over the wall.
Did they come back with a wooden Trojan rabbit?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my historically profound historical knowledge.
All right.
Knight Bedivere and his science.
Yeah, which he doesn't science too good, because he puts together a Trojan rabbit and then they wheeled it up to the castle. And like, this is one of the more weirder elements of the movie, is they take a long time for a joke to set in. Like, they're taking a really long time to tell a joke. And then when the punchline comes, it comes like pretty much as like a left hook. So they take all this time showing this this rabbit getting made. You hear
They don't show the rabbit being made, but you've got the French guys looking over the wall and they're just like, what's all that noise coming from the forest?
And it sounds like, you know, trees are getting cut down. You hear like chainsaws, I think, at one point. Mm-hmm. And then they put together this wooden Trojan rabbit and they wheeled it up, and there's like a good chunk of time that's devoted to like the French guys looking like, can we take this in? And
yeah, so they say rabbit in French a bunch of times, but I forgot to write it down.
And so they take in the rabbit, and then
we cut back to the knights,
and Bedivere is saying, okay, so Lancelot, Galahad, and myself will hide in there, and then when the night comes, we'll go ahead and sneak out and take them by surprise. And Arthur's like,
what?
Which knights again? And he's like, Lancelot, Galahad, and myself.
He's pointing to them while they're laying in a field explaining this to King Arthur.
And then it's very obviously not gonna work. But do you know what the French guys do? They catapult the Trojan rabbit.
Like, they threw all that livestock over the wall earlier.
Yeah, they're just sort of like, yep, we're just going to go ahead and throw this over the wall too.
which lands on a guy with coconuts, one of the squires. Mm-hmm. And he's actually like the music producer, or he's the writer, because they didn't have a budget. He was like not just some random extra. He was a guy who was doing music for the show.
This is why you should always have your contractors deliver a statement of work before you begin. Because if they had known exactly what was going to happen with that rabbit,
he might not have been hurt.
During the screenings of this film, Terry Gilliam, I'm pretty sure, but I could be wrong because I only read the IMDb page once, recognized that they had a lot of musical score. And whenever, during the first showing, when the punchlines would land with music going, people didn't laugh as much. So he went back and he edited out all of the music during punchlines. And so, I just say this because ironically, when the Trojan rabbit lands on the guy who produced music, there was like no music playing so that you would remember to laugh at the guy who got squashed by a fake rabbit.
That's cool. Yeah. And then we see a famous historian appear talking about the defeat that Arthur had at the castle. And then he dies.
Yeah, he's like, during this time, King Arthur decided that he needed a change of place, which indicates that him and his party needed to split up, creating more vignettes for us all. But then, I forget which knight drive rolls by. I missed it both times. I tried, but like... I
feel like it's just some random knight.
No, it's like Galahad or Lancelot. I just can't remember which one it is. Mm-hmm. Anyways, knight runs by this guy who's been filmed for like a educational school film. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a historical documentary. He's like, well, no, King Arthur. I mean, he gets slit in the throat, right? The woman who runs on is the wife of a producer. She does a fantastic job. Yeah. She turns out to be very, and I know I say this phrase a lot, but integral to the plot.
Yeah.
Like, she runs on, and she's like, no! And he's, like, dead on the ground, and she looks shocked, and then they cut away.
Yeah. But it's important to the plot in the long run.
This is where I start referring to anything that references this dead historian as NCIS. Because, I mean, like, that's every time it cut to it, I was like, NCIS time! And it's only, it's always less than 10 seconds, but they reference it again and again, and it's important. So if we see that guy, just know that I'm thinking, NCIS!
All right.
But then we go to Robin.
Brave, brave Sir Robin, brave Sir Robin, brave Sir Robin.
Do you want to sing the song, Johnny? Do you know the words? Google it real fast and be just like, brave Sir Robin, he's never turned on her. He's a Robin, brave Sir Robin. I want to sing it really bad all of a sudden.
Why, though?
Because, okay, so the great thing about the Brave Sir Robin bard is that everybody wants the bard to be awesome. I don't know if you've D&D'd much, but it's not easy to be a bard because you can't be witty right off the top of your head most of the time. Mm-hmm. In olden times, bards would spend, you know, a long time writing things. When you're playing D&D, they're like, and then the bard said something witty and they all look at you and you're like,
that doesn't sound very improvised.
I would just quote Adventure Time. I think.
How would you quote Adventure Time in relation to this scene?
I don't know. If I knew Adventure Time, I'm not a bard. But I'll tell you
I'll do the music for you.
Bravely bold Sir Robin rode forth from Camelot. He was not afraid to die. Oh, brave Sir. I don't know.
It pretty much is talking about how he's not afraid to die. He can go ahead and, like, all these crappy things can happen to him.
Both of his elbows broken. His body can get burned away. He's going to get his face smashed. It's going to be amazing. And Robin's like,
I think at one point they say he could have his nostrils and he'd still be fine.
Yeah, he does. The funny thing is the bard is falling behind Sir Robin, who has a giant scaredy chicken on his shield. And he keeps looking back at him like, dude, what? I don't want any of that. I really don't. And
I do have the lyrics.
Well, you can publish them to our Facebook page because they're amazing. We won't force you to sing anymore. It's just important because they're walking past they're riding their horses, air quotes, past all of these beware signs that get worse and worse.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, let's, like, they're riding through a beautiful field of, like, purple flowers. And he's like, hey, let's not sing that anymore.
Yeah, the minstrels aren't helping at all, especially this one guy who's saying all the lines. They come across a three-headed guy.
But what, you know, where they cut off the song is pretty important.
Okay.
To every man.
Oh, please tell us the every man important lyric.
How about I give you the last four lines?
Please, I think that we need that.
Before the cutoff.
Okay.
And his bowels unplugged and his nostrils... And his bottom burnt off, and his penis, and that's where it's cut. That's where it cuts off. That's enough music for now, lads. There's dirty work afoot. There's dirty work afoot.
Then they come across the three-headed giant.
Right. And when they're like, who are you? His minstrel's like, his brave Sir Robin. And
he's like, no. He, like, keeps cutting him off. He's like, don't keep killing him. Yeah.
He's just like, I'm no one. And they, like, I think at one point it comes out that he's a member of the Knights of the Round Table and the three headed.
Like, what are you here for? He's not afraid to fight.
Yeah. And the three headed guys are arguing amongst themselves.
So there's the angry kill him guy on. Okay, when you're looking at the screen, the guy on the left is like, let's kill him. Yeah. The one in the middle is like, I don't know. And the guy on the right's like, let's let him go and have tea.
Yeah, tea and crumpets, cakes.
Not cakes. All right, not cakes, but let's kill him.
And then they all agree to go ahead and kill him.
They spend like 2 minutes of banter deciding whether or not they're going to kill him. And then they look down.
and he's gone.
He's gone and buggered off.
His minstrels are saying that he bravely ran away. And he's like, no, I didn't. No, it's not true.
Yeah. I mean, the bard is definitely the star of this scene.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, all we need to say about that. Because mm-hmm. then we cut to an animation, which I always enjoy, of the monks performing the song again, Thwonka themselves, and then they fling themselves into a pond and accidentally gets flung into another part of the animation, which mm-hmm. is all very well and good, because then it goes, the tale of Sir Galahad.
The tale of Sir Galahad.
Which is led into from the animation with the monks.
Mm-hmm.
He looks miserable. And I will note that because the majority of their costuming was wool knitted together and then painted to look like chainmail.
Yeah.
It held a lot of water.
Oh, wow.
And they were constantly cold and wet. And the hotel that they were staying at had a limited number of hot baths. Hey, Sprinkles. So they'd cut for the day, and then they would make a mad dash back to the hotel to see who could get warmed up faster. Yeah. But, I mean, no one, in my opinion, suffers more than Sir Galahad, because he is, like, rolling around in the mud and throwing himself down. And it seems a bit like the Rocky Horror intro, as the Brad and Janet are, like, making their way to the castle, except for that they're, like, I mean, they're just walking there, but mm-hmm. and it's cold and wet and miserable. But he is, like, he sees the castle, and it's like, there's a light over at the Frankenstein's place. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. It's a grail-shaped light, by the way.
He's a grail over a castle, and he's like, oh, yeah! And he, like, makes it there. And he throws himself through a door, and he lands on the ground, and the door closes behind him.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I hope that's a good setup, because that's how I felt about it.
And then we're introduced to the inhabitants of this castle, and also the name of the castle, which is Castle Anthrax.
It's an unfortunate name.
Mm. And this woman who introduces the name of the castle is introduced as Newt.
Zoot.
Thank you. And it's just this collection of attractive women, blondes and brunettes.
16 to 19 and a half year old.
Maybe I'm just an American prude, but 16 and 17 and even 18 seems a little bit young.
I mean, if you're listening to this and you're like, that's really old, then you, nope.
Then we don't have any words for you.
Here's what I'm going to say. This entire scene, which I do love, is a teenage masturbatory fantasy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I can see it from both sides. I mean, I can see it from the
male perspective
and the female perspective. And you can flip those things. Like, the idea of showing up somewhere and, like, you're all they've ever wanted and all they mm-hmm. want is you. And, like,
yeah.
The flippity floppity of it. Like, I don't mean to. I mean, it's definitely a sexual.
Well,
scene.
Naomi, I don't think flippity or floppity would be used adequately in the way that most of the audience members are seeing this scene. I mean, maybe it's just me. It just seems like one really long block joke.
It is exactly that.
And this scene made me, like, when I watched this last time, not this last time when we watched it, but when I was writing my notes, I was like, you know, I don't think I find blocking jokes that funny. Like, even if you were talking about, like, it from a female perspective, it's just like, I mean, the joke is that someone isn't going to have sex.
What I like is that, as a former prude,
yeah,
like, I say this as a married woman, like, as a former prude, like, the uncomfortableness of somebody who's open about what they want, and so like, Sir Galahad is like, he's like, no, this isn't my deal. And she's like, all we're asking for is these innocent things, and presents them as non-sexual. Mm-hmm. And it's that continuous, like, this unprying of this prude by these totally non-sexual demands is mm-hmm. like, it's compelling, because it's like, oh, no, it's, well, if it's innocent, oh, no, but what we're asking for is so nonchalant. Like, it's as much as the punchline of the scene is a block.
Yeah.
The
buildup is not a blocking buildup.
What it really is that it's manipulating the uncomfortable. And that's a trope that Monty Python uses again and again. They're like, oh, are you uncomfortable in this situation? Like you were saying earlier about the scene in the Flying Circus where they were like trying, you're supposed to be confronting death right now, but their like eyes are elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Like when you're all about your own chastity, you're like, you are hyper focused. It's a point that South Park makes about purity rings. Like, mm-hmm. like it's not about, hey, you will eventually have a sexual partner if you'd like, but you, and you should think about it, but it shouldn't be the focus of your development. You know, you got your whole life to find somebody to have a relationship with, or you might have multiple relationships. That's all part of growing up. Right.
Right.
But what happens when you put a purity ring on is you're like, now you're going to think about sex every time you look at your finger. Right. So when Sir Galahad's like, I'm Sir Galahad the Chaste. And they're like, that's great. We're all young, nubile, totally fertile females who totally want you to touch our bodies. No, we're not asking for sex, but just touch our bodies. Like, that's all his brain is hyper-focused on. And so he's, like, super uncomfortable. And it's that uncomfortableness that is the joke for me in this scene. It's not necessarily about the punchline, although I'm glad we get there.
Yeah.
Because the punchline is John Cleese. But I really like the whole, and it sucks because I would forage through jungles to make sure another person isn't uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's the joke,
yeah,
I'm gonna enjoy watching you squirm a bit.
And thank you for that explanation, because that puts a completely different spin on this than I would have ever thought. So I do thank you for that. Because, like, I mean, there is...
Also, I didn't write down the word block, which is, like, the best.
It's a blocking joke. But, no, I mean, there is this level of, like, this level of chastity that kind of comes up in not just, like, you know, European culture. Like, I mean, his name is Galahad the Chaste.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like, okay, he, at the beginning, he's very much like, you know, I'm not comfortable with this because I made a vow.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of like realizes, you know what, maybe I've been limiting myself.
I mean, everybody here is willing.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a part of him that just kind of changes his mind at the last second, which I can't fault anybody on. You know, changing their mind at the last second for any reason, because I do it every day.
We spend all this time unwrapping his character so that he's willing to spank these women into submission, which, you know what? If you're willing and adultish, okay, here's the thing, 18 and up for me.
Yeah.
Just saying. But, like, that's got to be, like, half the people there.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, all right, I'll be your knight. And then, there is that break in exposition where twin sister Dingo is like, well, I think the scene is going very well. And then they cut to everybody being like, our scene has better structure. Our scene isn't a whole bunch of...
Yeah.
Like,
and then they go, get on with it.
Get on with it. Which is also in large letters in my notes. Get on with it. Because that part does stretch a bit. Okay. So my notes then go, lulz, he's rescued.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. So Sir Lancelot comes in and he's all like, I'll rescue you. These heathens, these sirens, these temptresses. And he's like, no, I'm and she's like, I can deal with these ladies one-handed. Yes, let him deal with these ladies one-handed.
And they're like, there's only 150 of them. I can take them. He's like, yes, he can take us. Let him take all of us.
So Lancelot drags him out. And then Dingo is standing there and she's just like, oh.
Because, like, for how repressed Galahad is, apparently these ladies are just as frustrated, too.
I mean, but then, okay, and this is kind of the time, but also a little progressive, because let me tell you why. On the outside, Galahad goes, I bet you're gay. And Sir Lancelot goes, no, I'm not. And then they walk off screen and it's the end of the scene, right?
Yeah.
But 30 years later, when they made Spamalot,
mm-hmm.
Prince Hubert, who we're going to meet in just a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Prince Hubert is gay.
Yeah.
In the play, it's more obvious.
Okay.
But Prince Hubert in the play helps bring Lancelot out of the closet, and he is in fact gay. And I mean, like, it feels a bit like a throwaway line in 1975 that's kind of offensive, but then to bring it back 30 years later and kind of make it a thing where it's like, you know what? He's gay, for real.
Yeah.
I'm like, good on you.
Yeah.
Good. I think that's something that they address time to time in all of the Monty Python, is messing with gender norms and like sexual identity. Like they do that again and again, and they do it in a way that might be prudishly British, but is they make it in a way that makes it doesn't seem very dismissive. I don't feel like they're abusing a lot of gay people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they do when they dress as women to play the part. It's very Shakespearean.
Yeah.
It's just a man who's playing a woman. It's not a man in drag. And Kids in the Hall,
right,
Call Out did that too. They mm-hmm. just didn't have women in the cast. And although you might find umbrage with that, you can't. I mean, if it's just, this is the cast we have to work with, and we need right. a female in this scene.
Well, and the line where Galahad says, I bet you're gay. And I mean, the fact that John Cleese, you know, comes back and says, no, I'm not. It doesn't feel like he's saying it defensively. He's just kind of like saying, no, now let's get on, because I'm kind of helping you in your long-term goals of chastity. And you're making a one-time mistake that's going to ultimately take you away from that. I'm like, dude, I'm helping you.
Mm-hmm.
Stop being such a...
Mm-hmm. The narrator. There's a narrator that comes in who's been in and out of this whole deal. And he gets shot or something, right?
Yeah. So we see the gorilla hand on the book again. And then there's a narrator talking about how Arthur and Bedivere, are going to meet an old man in a hut. But then the narrator goes on about swallows, and then he just does not shut up about it, to the point where it gets him killed.
Yeah. So then Arthur and them are in some spooky woods with what I would call a hermit.
Mm-hmm.
He's all dirty and he's prophetic and stuff, and that's hermit territory as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I do think it's nice. It's a bit, it kind of like goes from this funny moment with a narrator dying because he's talking about unladen swallows, and then it kind of goes like, it very gradually moves into like this horror movie-esque element where like the guy just kind of like picks up and leaves, and then there's this shot of the two of them not being in the hut anymore.
Yes, that makes me think of Brave.
Yeah,
a little bit. But it's he goes, seek you. I can't do the voice, but he's like, he's a hermit-y voice, so I'm gonna fake it right now.
Yeah.
He goes, seek you the bridge of death,
and then he starts cackling. And then they're like walking, and then there's like no more hut around them. And then we see them walking through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like some really nice buildup, like that would be perfect for a horror movie. And then it cuts
knee.
To the knights who say
knee.
Knee. Oh, excuse me. They're the knights who say knee, pang, and knee womb.
Knee womb.
I think I specifically stopped the movie and had the subtitles on so I could write down what the subtitles say.
I just rewound it 3 times so I could write it down phonically. Yeah. I was like, nee, ping, and nee, woom.
Yeah. See, that's better, like, that's better voice acting. Like, you hit those. Like, it's not just pang, it's ping.
Yeah.
It's the sound.
Nee, ping, nee, woom. I love that you know they had to sit around and practice together. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just dude who was supposed to originally be on John Cleese's shoulders in mm-hmm. like you know, the two kids in a suit style, but he ended up on a ladder. But then he's got all these little knee knights around him who are just around him going knee, knee, knee. And they all look like, you know, the Labyrinth, David Bowie's The Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah.
I shouldn't say David, it's just Jim Henson's Labyrinth, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like all of the little knights who are just helmets.
The goblins.
Kind of, yeah, the goblins, yeah. And these giant oversized helmets. That's all they remind me of. And they're just around, like, echoing this giant knight who's, like, yeah, on a ladder, but he's one giant.
It's adorable.
And they're like, nee, nee.
And, like, nee. This is a word that really hurts Arthur and Bedivere, like, to the point where you can see them in agony every time the word knee is said.
Ah.
Like, ah.
Ah.
And then,
I mean, there's like, here's, I love, here's the thing about magic is like the power of words, but do you have any words that cause you to more than emotionally recoil?
I guess moist is like the closest one that makes me like recoil a little bit.
I'm over it. But if I see like, if I see a white person use a racist term that's real obviously racist, like you're always going to find, oh God. And here's the thing. You can yell at me online if you need to, but like, you're always going to find somebody who's like, well, the term cotton picking hands is, I had white relatives who picked cotton, like those people.
Right.
But there are people who will like use the N word, but be like, I'm using it casually with friends, so it totally doesn't matter. And I'm like, it really does, because you're white.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to. And it's not because I don't think you're cool with your friends, and it's not because I don't think you don't have black friends. It's just that we as an ethnicity don't have the right to use that at all.
Right, because certain history has put into the culture words that...
Here's the thing, that word doesn't belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I am for pushing past social barriers, as much as I love the fact that we are able to use the word queer now in a way that 20, 30 years ago, I mean, I've met people who are transgender who are still uncomfortable with that word.
Mm-hmm.
But I am part of a culture right now that's like, no, queer accurately describes who and what I am. And I'm neither.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm both. And it's a strange idea to comprehend. And the true meaning of the word queer is a strange idea that's hard to comprehend.
Right.
And it feels good to be able to use that appropriately. But I can see people using that word and me feeling like I need to correct them about it.
Right.
So, and I know that's a weird tangent, but it's the only equivalent I have to the fact that they say knee. And it really upsets them. So I wonder exactly what knee might mean.
Right, right. And it's
the same reason why I needed to look up Knigget.
Yeah. And so the knights go ahead and demand a sacrifice in the form of a shrubbery.
Hmm.
And I mean, it kind of catches Arthur off guard. Like, okay, I think we could go ahead and do that.
Then we cut to the second NCIS scene where the dead body is being covered with like a body bag.
Yeah. And then we have the tale of Sir Lancelot.
Hmm.
And this is probably one of my favorite scenes out of the entire movie.
It's led in with an animation scene,
mm-hmm,
of this, the setting, the guy telling the sun and the clouds to go away.
Yeah, because they're making too much noise and they're messing up his stuff.
And then he goes back in the house and he's like, bloody weather. And I'm like, all right, the clouds are weather, but the sun is just the sun.
Yeah. And then we get a man lecturing his son about his responsibility while bringing up the fact that he is bad at planning construction. Four, like three castles. Like, he was like, the first castle we built.
They told me it couldn't be done.
And then it sank in the swamp. And then the second castle sank in the swamp again. And the third castle got burned and sank in the swamp.
It caught on fire, and then that one sank.
This castle is standing strong because it has a foundation of three broken castles underneath it. I feel like that's a metaphor for something.
Anyways. Man. This is Prince Hubert we're talking about. The wig work in this film, let us address it now, is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, the ladies all in the castle, Anthrax, their wigs, on point.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Hubert, on point. They were going to make Lancelot a blonde, but they decided it made him look really weird, so they decided not to.
I think he's better with just the chainmail headpiece.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally into it. I've always loved Lancelot.
Yeah.
Because, maybe.
And the son doesn't want to get married to Princess Lucky.
Princess Lucky.
Which the king is trying to get him to marry because she has huge tracts of land. And so...
I don't want to get married. I just want to...
No, 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 no.
See?
No, 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 no. Like, the father, like, knows when the music's swelling up in his son's room, and he will come in and just say, nope, nope, don't do that. Don't do that. You're not allowed to do that.
This is where my notes say I heart idiot arguments again, but now I've used hearts to color it in. And I've hearted the statement because the king is now like, shut your noise, you, and get that suit on.
And as the king leaves, or the lord leaves, he tells the guards to stay here until he comes back for his son and make sure his son doesn't leave.
So to clarify, the back and forth for the next 3.5 minutes, it feels like.
Right.
And they're just like, all right, you said once you leave, none of us leave but your son or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's all wrong for like this whole time. And it's an idiot argument. And I can't accurately describe it to you without like doing the whole thing.
Right. It feels a lot like they're the Monty Python's version of Who's On First.
Yes! I do love me some Who's On First.
Yeah, yeah. And it feels like, I mean, when you talk about idiot arguments throughout all of Monty Python, there's a part of me that's like, it would make sense that them doing Who's On First would be a bit of an idiot argument.
Yeah, because you've got one person who knows what they're talking about, and then another person who has no freaking clue. And, I mean... It's always hilarious to watch somebody who knows and somebody who doesn't know and have it be like this all the time. Just like,
And when the Lord leaves, we see Herbert writing a note and very, like, he's very obviously sticking the note to an arrow.
The guards are staring at him, smiling the entire time, and he's just like, I'm being sneaky. And he's, like, continuously backing towards the window with all this stuff.
And then he shoots an arrow that lands in Lancelot's squire's chest.
Yeah, I think his name is Concord.
Concord.
He's like, okay, here's my notes. It says, "It's there's no stupid way they'd stop you from sending an arrow."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, I mean, they just wouldn't. Like, that wasn't even part of the orders. It was hard enough to comprehend, stand here and don't let this kid out.
Yeah.
There was no, oh, and by the way, don't let him shoot an arrow at the window. That would have been a third level of that argument. That's like, all right, let him out to shoot an arrow.
They would have been there another, like, 15 minutes just trying to comprehend that one thing.
So then Lancelot and Concord, he's like, Concord doesn't die, but Lancelot is like, oh, no, you're going to die. He's like, no, I actually don't think I'm going to die. Oh, you got a mortal wound. No, I don't actually have a mortal wound.
I think I'll be fine, actually.
Yeah, I think you should just stay here. And Concord just lays there. And he's like, okay. Yeah. All right.
But Lancelot goes to the castle because he thinks that a fair maiden is going to get married off by her father.
Yes, against her will. We're at minute 54 of this film.
We're almost halfway through.
Yay! And then, but it's a really beautiful scene. They've got all these flowers and these great costumes, and they're dancing and they're drinking, and everybody's carrying flowers everywhere.
Bride is having her hair braided.
Oh, Princess Lucky.
That's so adorable. And then we see the guards looking outward as Lancelot is running towards them, sword brandished.
I counted it this last time with Lydia, bless her heart for putting up with me, but it was like five cut scenes that I think they, in the movie Kung Pao Enter the Fist, I think they make an homage to this.
Mm-hmm.
They cut to somebody running towards the castle, and every time they cut to him, he's still far away. So yeah. It's like, he's running to the castle, oh no! And they cut to the guard who's eating an apple, and then they cut back to him, and he's back where he started, and then he's running towards the castle, and they do it five times.
And here's the thing, the repetition of it, it seems like, if you told someone this joke, they would probably not find it funny, but when you sit down and you watch it, it makes so much sense.
It feels like he's running towards the castle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's back where he was running towards the castle. That's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe they did that a third time. Okay, but then they do it the fifth time, and you're like, oh my God.
Like, when is this going to stop? Am I going crazy?
So then the fifth time, you're like, I don't even know where this is going. And then they launch into him slaughtering people.
Oh, yeah. He gets one of the guards. He gets, like, so many of the dancing handmaidens.
Like, nine of the guests and the man of honor, right?
Yeah. The minstrels. He, like, chops something, and their entire stand or stage just, like, crumbles.
He cuts through these people doing a little, I would call it a pole dance, except they're just dancing in kind of a cylindrical, like they're dancing in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like I want to call it a swastika, but that's not right. It's just that they're all radiating from a central dancer in like four or five different points. He cuts right through them, killing half of them, and then there's three of them left.
Yeah,
and they continue to dance in the circle as he goes up into the castle.
He kicks the bride in the chest. He like skewers her father, and he gets all the way up to where Prince Herbert is. And he's just sort of like, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were a fair maiden. And Prince Herbert's just like, oh, I got a rope. You're getting here to rescue me. And then he like goes out the window.
Yeah. And so the Lancelot's talking to the king. He's like, you've killed everybody in the thing. And they start having this banter about, you know, eventually landing on the king or the lord or whatever, wanting to have Lancelot be his champion. But Prince Hubert's like climbed out the window, and the king does it. The lord or whatever. He cuts the bedsheet rope that Hubert made and causes his son to fall to his death.
And then the Lord takes Lancelot down into the area where he's just caused all this massacre. And then, like, the people start going after Lancelot, and Lancelot just goes into beast mode.
He kills more people, right?
Yeah.
But there is the part where the king is like, oh, we're going to get him married to the lady, and it's going to be like a whole thing. And then they're like, but he's killed so and such and such. And then the guy's like, oh, he's getting better. Like, that's a nice callback.
It's like the whole scene with Concord, only with the bride's father, because the Lord makes this whole speech about how I don't see, like, my own son has died, but I don't see this as me losing a son, but gaining a daughter, which everybody claps at because it's such a, like, common wedding thing to say.
Yes, it is.
And then he's like, and then with the death of her father, and there was just sort of like, oh, I think he's going to get better. And then they go through, you know, he's feeling fine. And he's like, with the death of her father, with the mortal stabbing and
possible, like, doesn't somebody walk over and kill him?
Yeah, he nods to one of the guards and one of the guards kills him, like, very obviously, because this lord wants the land that would be given to him from this marriage.
Right. But then he's trying to promise off Lancelot to seal the deal. But then Prince Hubert walks into the room.
Right. He gets carried in by Concord.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
He didn't even notice it was Concord.
And then he starts...
It freaking would be, Lydia. Yeah. It would be.
And the Lord, Herbert's ramping up a song, and, like,
I call it the unstoppable singing sequence.
Yeah, but this is, like, the fifth time that he tries to sing, and his father can't stop it, because everybody is siding with Herbert at this point.
Yes.
And then Lancelot swings out dramatically.
But then swings back in, because he apparently didn't make it to a window or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, could somebody please give me a push? So... King Arthur again.
Yeah, and this is the second time that I saw someone beating a cat. It was when they were going to see the old lady.
Oh,
and
yeah. She's called the crone.
Mm-hmm.
And the actress didn't live long enough to see the movie premiere.
Oh.
So when you see her, love her instantly, because one, she does a fantastic job.
Yeah.
But two, she never got to see the fruits of her labor.
Right.
She's so cute. She's like... Okay, you can lean into it.
So Arthur and Bedivere are asking her where they can find a shrubbery.
There's no shrubberies around here.
And so they say...
No, we're going.
They say, if you don't tell us where a shrubbery is, we're going to have to, you know, say knee at you.
Do your worst.
Knee. 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 She's just diving headfirst into this role, and she gives it all she has.
She's all covered in warts, and she's like this chubby little old lady. Mm-hmm. And you just, I mean, I love her.
Yeah, it's hard not to love her. And then Eric Idle comes by.
Bless.
Did I get his name right? It's Eric Idle, right?
I'm 90% sure.
Yeah. So he shows up on a cart and he says, oh, what's the world coming to when random people can go ahead and say knee to helpless old ladies? Even I, a shrubber, Roger the Shrubber.
I wrote it down, Roger the Shrubber.
And even I am finding financial hardship in this day and age. And
they're like, oh.
And then Bedivere is like, knee, knee.
He, like, goes after him. King Arthur's like, no. It's like, it's the guy you need. Like, no, shut up.
And so they get a shrubbery and they take it back to the knights.
Knights who say knee, we have brought you the shrubbery. We are no longer the knights who say knee.
We are now the knights who say knee.
Wait a second. Applauders. We're going to write down Lydia's accurate writing down probably from subtitles.
Yeah.
And then my inaccurate phonic writing down from when I was like, oh, I should probably write this down.
Okay, so icky, 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 patang, zoo, boing, azawa. Aruza? Okay. I wrote it down as Aruza.
Okay, mine. Anyways. I wrote down in speedy freaking cursive, so it ain't good.
Yeah.
It's, we are now the knights who say, icky, 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 patang. Things that way. And then a little knight behind him goes, knee.
It was great.
So cute.
And then their demands increase. They want not just one shrubbery. They want a second shrubbery with a nice little, like, path going in the middle.
A path, they all say behind
yeah.
him.
Yeah. And then they have to cut down this large tree.
The mightiest tree in the forest.
With a herring. And then that's when Arthur's just like, look, this is ridiculous. And... like, they start saying the word it.
Okay, but so, you didn't, it's not wrong.
Okay.
Brave knight Sir Robin shows up, and he's like, and his bard's like, proudly ran away.
Yeah.
So, he did not want to fight.
The party regroups.
In front of the icky, icky, patang, zowie.
Yeah, and they start saying the word it, and that apparently is the one word that stops these knights.
They can't stand that word. What yeah. word? You just said it. No, I've said it. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, then we cut to?
Animation.
Nope.
No.
Dead historian in NCIS.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Is this the one where they have more of the police there?
Yes.
Yes, because it's, I think the next one isn't until, we see the beast.
Right.
Or not the beast, but the little beast.
Right.
The big little beast. But then you're right, it goes, then it goes to the animation.
Right. Where they talk about the party regrouping. Mm-hmm. And there was much rejoicing.
And they met up with Lancelot again in that animation. Yeah.
Robin's minstrels got eaten during the winter.
Praise the Lord.
And it sounds like 2 years have passed.
Yeah. Yeah. We're at minute 105, by the way.
Yeah. And then they come across a guy who's just blowing up.
Oh, yeah. Some people call... Okay, so the idea is that John Cleese didn't remember his actual name from the script, but he's also gone on record saying that nothing has been ad-libbed from his perspective, right? But he goes, who are you? King Arthur says. And then John Cleese goes... he's dressed as this wizard type with these rolling ram's horn type headdress and this long flowing beard. And he goes, some people call me Tim.
It's kind of like Dennis. Like, not every medieval name has to be, like, super funny.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the pyrotechnics in this scene. I mean, yeah. he's got a flame-shooting staff, and he, like, points it and stuff, and it blows up. And, like, the pyro team in this part, so good.
So on point.
I love it. I love it.
And so Tim the Enchanter joins their party, and he directs them.
Who are you looking for? A grail? And like, King Arthur is so intimidated. He's like, oh, yeah. Exactly. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I've only been commissioned by God to do a couple things and nothing as fancy as a grail, but let me tell you, if you know, you know. You know, even in the face of pyrotechnic Tim.
Yeah, and Tim points them in the direction of a cave, but that will show them the location of the castle. But it's guarded by a hideous monster with, like, there's this long description that Tim the Enchanter gives on this monster, and it ends with big pointy teeth, and he like puts three fingers up to his mouth, and he's like gnawing, pantomiming. Yeah, it. Yes.
Arthur turns around and is like, we gotta go, and then like John Cleese is behind him being like, ang, 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 it's so cute. It's just like the weird little visuals that they do, like improv, is like so good. You got to be a man of valor to go fight this beast, apparently. Mm-hmm. And so the party moves on towards and then Tim is like, we're close or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Arthur says we need to dismount. So all of these knights, like they all in unison kind of like throw their right leg back and they like do this little bouncy dismount.
Because they're not on actual horses. They're pantomiming the horses.
Yes. And this is where we lose all of like the squires or whatever who are using the coconut noise. And we come down to the core of the cast.
Kingly Karma is about to catch up with our bantering brethren if they believed they'd seen the last of flying furry friends, wooden or otherwise. Thank you, Applauder, for gallivanting with us through the tale of Galahad, running laps with Lancelot, and braving through my attempts at reenacting Sir Robin's run-ins. Hey, this is your audio engineer and... Tim? Just go with it, Jonathan. Giving you advanced warning that we still have a lot to cover. Who knows when Brexit will cause all Britain films to be globally banned? VHS tapes don't go offline. Just saying. Stock up. Speaking of stocking up, did you know that when you become a $5 per month Applauder, you get our full back catalog of unbleeped episodes and help gather finances for unintrusive, out-of-the-way advertising? Search for Shocked and Applaud on Patreon, and we'll give you the hookup. Part 2 of our review of Monty Python and the Holy Grail has concluded, but if you're counting correctly, we still have Part 3. We still have Part 3 in only 1 week. In the story of Britain's entrance to the world. How close was I? Was that a good take? From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.